During times of political uncertainty, where do you turn to for a much-needed reality check? The rise of online media was supposed to democratize the media. Instead, it's given many in the print sector a greater sense of identity. But even during an election season, remaining relevant is a tricky business. We'll assess the state of the industry today on The Stack. From Midori House here in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Tyler Brulé. Later in the programme, we'll jet off to Beirut to visit one of the city's most interesting publishing and design firms, Studio Safar.
And that was the inspiration for Journal Safar, where we could kind of like co-found an independent magazine or a platform for visual artists, designers, photographers and illustrators, poets, etc., to kind of reflect on the visual culture in the region.
But first, on paper, the United States Republican Party looks to be in pretty good shape. They have a president in the White House, and they're in control of Congress, too. But if politics is a game of popularity, the Republicans aren't doing so well. America's most popular politician is not a stalwart of the GOP. It's not Hillary Clinton, and it's certainly not President Trump. It's Bernie Sanders. Christoph Ament is the editor of Germany's Zeit magazine. He hosted a talk with Bernie Sanders in Berlin this week. Hello, Christoph.
Hi, Tyler.
Now, it wasn't enough that we had a bit of a love-in between Chancellor Merkel and, of course, President Obama just the week before last. But now, of course, Zeit magazine had Bernie Sanders in town. Tell us, I mean, obviously you do a lot of conferences, you have an ongoing speaker series, but why Bernie Sanders and why now?
Well, we invited Bernie Sanders together with his book publisher to come over to talk about his book and, of course, talk about what's happening in the world today. And I have to say that I've never had a sort of an experience with a live talk with a politician like him. There were 1,200 people in the audience, and they were cheering him like he was a pop star. Like, you know, if someone has doubts about millennials not being interested in politics, I mean, that evening showed the opposite. And yeah, it was actually the day when the news broke that President Trump would pull out of the Paris Treaty. So Senator Sanders was 40 minutes late because he was still working on his speech for the event, which is, yeah, really nice. And so I was sitting next to him and I saw his handwritten notes just before he went on stage, and then we had a chat.
Now, tell me, of course, Berlin has, it's a very international capital, as we know. It's become, of course, a bit of a hub and magnet for young people from all over the world wanting to relocate and have a bit of an experience somewhere else. So if I was to look out across the audience at those 1,200 faces, was a lot of it made up of the U.S. diaspora in Berlin, or was it a pretty mixed bag, many Germans in the mix as well?
Yeah, it was a pretty mixed audience. I mean, at one point, Bernie Sanders asked the audience, you know, who's from America here? And then probably, I don't know, 200 hands raised. So it was really an international audience, many young Berliners, old Berliners cheering up. And, you know, he said when he started his presidential campaign, he had no clue what millennials are. He hadn't even heard about the word. And then he soon found out during his campaign. So it was interesting to talk about how to run a political campaign when you had no money and you had no organization in the first place.
Of course, we're on The Stack today, a program which is always looking at shifts and trends in the world of media. You said you paired up with a publisher. Of course, this was centered on promoting Mr. Sanders' new book. How important are events when you are a weekly newspaper coming out on a Thursday? Of course, you're the editor of a very fine supplement, which we all like. But how much in terms of really sort of the rhythm, and we won't get into revenue numbers, but is this type of forum for you? Because I believe you've done fashion this year and of course, a number of other things.
Yeah, we're doing a style conference at the beginning of Berlin Fashion Week twice a year. And we're doing different events. Next week, we're going to do an event at Documenta in Kassel together with our art magazine, Weltkunst. And we do around 200 events, the whole publishing house, in a year. So it's become a very important part of, well, on one hand, it's a very profitable business. But on the other hand, I think that, especially in digital times, people are so desperate to come together and to have this kind of unique life experience. And I think that sort of hunger for experiencing unique talks or evenings or matinees has really grown because of our digital lives, and that we're all, you know, stuck to our mobiles, you know, nearly 24 hours a day.
And you've given us a perfect transition and segue, because I believe it is exactly 1 month out. Well, in fact, you will have been off stage, because it was a month from yesterday that, of course, you'll be on stage when the Monocle Quality of Life conference rolls into Berlin. Now, we don't want you to give sort of too much away. I think probably a broader audience would love to certainly hear your reflections on some of the topics we were talking about in London with you earlier in the year. But I guess what everyone's sort of wondering, are you going to be leading the morning run and swim across the German Hauptstadt?
I'm actually doing morning runs in Gleisdreieck Park. And I know you, in Monocle, in the Berlin guide, you're writing about, your colleagues have been writing about Gleisdreieck Park, and I just live nearby. It's a new park that just opened up, I think, 3.5 years ago. So, yeah, I'll be doing my morning run over there.
Okay, a little bit more enthusiasm. But anyway, you heard it here first. Christoph Ammann, very, very good to chat to you. We look forward to seeing you in Berlin.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. When we come back in a moment, I'll be joined by our Chris Lord and Andrew Tuck. We'll be talking about, of course, that upcoming election here in the UK. Stay with us. You're back with The Stack on Monocle 24, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Tyler Brulé. Studio Safar is one of Beirut's most interesting design and art direction agencies, working across the realms of publishing, exhibitions, and packaging design. For creative directors Maya Mumne and Hatem Imam, Safar, meaning travel in Arabic, is more than a name. It's a reminder of the brand's drive to continue asking questions. The studio also publishes a magazine, Journal Safar. Monocle's Beirut correspondent Venetia Rainey caught up with Maya and Hatem to learn more.
So Hatem and I are also avid collectors of publications that were produced in the 70s and the 80s. Because at the time where you'd have books for children, for example, most of them would be translated from English books, and the illustrators of the books or the design of the books would often be foreign designers, like from the West. But there was one publishing house that would always commission Arab artists to do the design and the illustration and the writing, of course, so they wouldn't translate any of the books. One of the people behind that publishing house for children used to publish a magazine called Nazar, which means vision, on visual culture in the Arab world. And that was the inspiration for Jinan Safar, where we could kind of like co-found an independent magazine or a platform for visual artists, designers, photographers and illustrators, poets, etc., to kind of reflect on the visual culture in the region.
And so what's the content of this magazine like?
So it's also a magazine on visual culture. So be it publications or politics, comics, things that are found around him, the history of typography. This is different types of calligraphy from different parts of the Arab world.
And was that something that you felt was going completely unexamined before?
I mean, it's not unexamined, no, of course. I mean, there's a lot of academic papers, etc., but it's not something that you will find. And of course, online you have a bunch of blogs and websites. I mean, you don't find something similar in a form of a publication that could be disseminated and that could be easily accessible, and very specifically in Arabic. I mean, this is also a very important point for us. Like, even if a lot of the articles are written in English originally, we always make sure, you know, to translate everything to Arabic.
So tell me about that first issue of Journal Safar. What was it about, and sort of what was the process like to put it together and print it here?
First issue was a pilot issue, so it was much smaller than the second and the third one.
And tell me about the paper that you used.
So actually the paper for the pilot issue was kind of expensive paper. And then when we shifted to that layout, to number two and number three, we decided to go for newsprint.
And why did you choose that? Was that purely a financial decision? Or?
It was partly a financial decision, but also we liked the way that you handle the tactility of newsprint. And since the colors printed very nicely, we were like, okay, let's go for it. I mean, it does dissolve with time. It deteriorates with time, but I guess that's part of the process.
So a year later, issue two comes out, and it looks incredibly different. Talk to me a bit about what's happening here.
So when we started gathering our content, we started commissioning photographers, researchers, academics, poets and illustrators to contribute according to the theme. It was a little hard to get them to stick to the idea that the content has to revolve around visual culture, but we did our best with issue two. So once we realized that the articles were getting a little bigger, the contributions were crossing over spreader two, we were thinking of what are the ways where we can include Arabic and English in a magazine and still have it read in an interesting way and not make it boring, but still have it be legible. So we thought if we separate the text and the images completely and include these inserts into the magazine and have, you know, on one side the English and on the other side the Arabic, then you can still read the magazine in both languages. You don't have the interference of the text and the image, and you can still open the magazine from both directions and read it without repeating the content.
And tell me about your favorite piece in the current issue.
Basically, it's Ahmed Gharbi's piece, and it's kind of like a critique of the design of the new biometric Lebanese passport. We love this kind of contribution because it's something that is really rooted in, you know, like what's happening today on the visual cultural landscape in the country and also in the region. Because, I mean, he raises a lot of questions about, you know, things that have to do with the representation of the country, the kind of like stereotypical images that are used in the passport. And he asks, you know, like he posits some really interesting questions, and he, you know, proposes some, you know, I mean, what if, for example, you open your passport and instead of looking at images of Baalbek and Saida and different cities in Lebanon, you see images of different countries.
This is my favorite piece as well.
And tell me how this relates to Safar Studios. Is it, do you consider it sort of showcase for some of your work? Is it a completely sort of separate side project to explore the sort of wider world of design in the Middle East?
It's definitely not completely separate. It goes hand in hand with the way we work in the studio as well. And when we get commissioned by clients to do projects, it goes hand in hand with the way we work there as well. We like to experiment a lot with the conventions that we know, and we like to experiment a lot with the materials that are available to us.
But definitely, I mean, it's not used as a showcase, so you wouldn't find our commercial work in the magazine. But it's actually, you know, the way in which the magazine is designed and conceived, this is how it is actually, you know, part of our work somehow.
And talk to me briefly about sales. How well has it done here?
So not great. People don't like to buy magazines that much here, and I think that the magazine maybe looks a bit intimidating for the general viewer. I don't think that it looks like a magazine anybody would want to come and pick up. It is very attractive to designers, be it in the fashion industry or the architecture or product design. I mean, I know this because I've met a lot of people that have been like, oh, you're behind Journal Safa, people I don't know. So, I mean, from what I can tell so far, that was not the intention, that it would just be attractive to designers, but it just is attractive to, you know, people in the design field. And also because we don't have a distributor, we cannot distribute to all of the bookstores in the country. We can only distribute to those that are within our reach. So, for example, in the last launch, issue three, which happened at Souq Tayyib in Maram Khayil, we sold out all of the copies that the printer had sent us for the launch. So about 130 to 104 copies were sold out during the event, and that has not happened before. So the sales are increasing by the year, just to mention that.
Helps to throw a fabulous party.
Yeah. And we have been getting contacted by interested readers abroad, and we have no way of sending it to them. I mean, it's very expensive, and we can't guarantee it'll get there. So the next step is to contact the distributor and have it, you know, distributed around the world.
Maya Mumne and Hatam Imam of Studio Safar speaking to our Beirut correspondent, Venetia Rainey. You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24. It's the election that no one wanted, and if the polls are to be believed, even the Prime Minister might be regretting her decision to call a snap election here in the United Kingdom within the coming days. It's a confusing time for British politics with Brexit, the nation's delicate relationship with the United States, and a range of domestic issues all weighing on voters' minds. In times of uncertainty, many people traditionally turn to a trusted source of information for clarity, the Evening News, or their favorite broadsheet, or Newsweekly. But in a changing media landscape, have our expectations of the political print sector evolved? I'm joined by our features editor, Chris Lord, formerly our Istanbul bureau chief, and our editor, Andrew Tuck, has been dragged down from his desk and pile of pages as we send. the July-August issue off to print? Because you have a pile of pages on your desk as well. I don't want you to be left out.
I do. Mine are kind of moving, though. Mine are, yeah.
Good. Andrew's not.
Well, they're moving in what direction is that?
So Andrew's got editorial constipation or something. I just want to go back, rewind very quickly just to Berlin for a moment before we talk about, of course, papers in the election in this country. Are you excited about Berlin coming up? And Andrew, we had a meeting yesterday just talking about the lineup, and for those people who haven't attended in Berlin, and we have a few tickets left still, how's Berlin as a conference going to be different from what we did in Lisbon and Vienna last year?
Well, we have a completely different format. We've had two great years already where we've had, you know, quite deep discursive elements to the lineup, and we've tried to move it this time so that it's matched by actually some snappier elements as well. So we're bringing in some sessions where you only have 10 minutes to explain what you're up to.
Right.
We also have, because of where we're going to be in Berlin, an extraordinary city that, you know, its history, its cultural resonance, the wall, spying, all sorts of things. We're bringing in people who can reflect on that a little bit. So whether it's Anna Winger, who wrote this extraordinary TV series about Deutschland 83, about, you know, spying and the Stasi, whether it's Daniel Libeskind coming to talk about memory in the city. We have James Hawes, who's coming to talk about the history of the city. So when people come to Berlin, they'll get it unpacked for them in interesting ways. And we'll send them off to see interesting artists and ateliers and all sorts of things afterwards. So it's quite an immersive experience, actually.
Because you're looking forward to it, because you're going to take to the stage this for the first time this year.
That's the first time hearing about it, Tyler, but yeah.
I know, here we go. Andrew, we discussed before we went on.
I am very excited. I have to say, whenever we've had the conference before, I've always been manning the Istanbul Bureau before.
Yes.
So this is the first time I'm going to be able to get to one. Obviously, super exciting. Some of the speakers that we've got in there are great, as Andrew mentioned, really interesting people talking about that city itself and introducing that city a little bit more to people who even live there and sort of revealing some elements of it as well. And then some of the international guests, everything from great Turkish farmers to you know, academics talking about the history of the city. I think it's going to be great.
Excellent. Andrew, sorry.
I was just going to say, and what's also great is actually when you see the list of delegates coming, you know, we've got people coming from all over the world. Mm. And I think there's going to be lots of exchanging of business cards over drinks on various evenings.
Excellent. Let's talk about the election, which is, of course, just days ahead here in this country. As we were talking, and this, you know, of course, goes all the way back to probably, you know, off the back of, we could maybe even, you know, go back a year ago. I think if we were in sort of this Brexit footing this time last year, then of course we had a US election where sort of fake news came to the fore, and I think, you know, really, I would say sort of the domino effect after that. Chris, if you look at the front pages at the moment, the analysis, if you flip on Sky News, if you watch it maybe a step back, watching the likes of CNN or a CNBC covering it, do you think the viewer is looking at their bulletins in a different way? And also, if I'm an editor, you know, in charge of a program, if I'm overseeing the front pages, am I also thinking about my audience in a different way?
I think after the election of Donald Trump, I think there was so much soul searching that happened amongst news organizations in the US that the entire industry at large has had to think a little bit about what they're doing in the run-up to these major elections like this. The same happened here in Brexit. The fact that so many of the big papers over there in the US and the networks as well said, 2 days before, 8% chance of Donald Trump getting into power. And then on the night, everybody was left seeing a landslide in the complete a relative shift in the other direction. What I think that's meant is that a lot of people in the industry are having to ask, how do we make sure we don't get surprised again? How do we make sure that we go and talk to people about what is important to them? What is the feeling in these smaller towns around the UK? What's actually making their agenda? And I think you mentioned as well, Tyler, as well, I think fake news and misinformation is very, very important to people, as much, you know, certainly to readers as well. This has become common parlance now, this idea of fake news and misinformation. And I think a lot of listeners, readers, and people watching their TVs are looking to these big organisations to sift through it.
Mm. Andrew, you're with the Sunday paper in this country. It's no longer with us. But if you look across the nationals in the UK, do you think there was, yeah, people had to snap to attention and of course, you know, be very conscious of course, you know, many of the elements that Chris just pointed out? Or are we in a position where people have already fallen into bad habits? And also, this is a rather particular election as well.
But what's fascinating is that the polls are all over the place. So nobody can quite call it. Everyone's a bit nervous about what's happening, whatever side you're on. So the papers are, in the UK, are all politically aligned. And actually, they've lost some of their swagger and confidence over the last few weeks. So many of the newspapers on the right, who I think had imagined this was going to be a coronation, like Queen Victoria with Theresa May coming into power again, with, you know, people talking like 140-seat majority. Well, we've had stories this week saying, will she have a majority? Or if she does, will it be much reduced from what she went into the election with? And so the papers on the right are already playing a bit of a blame game. They're saying the BBC isn't being fair to Theresa May. Labour's got these bots on the web that are forcing people to read too much kind of like political campaigning by Labour. People aren't playing fair. It just happens to be that the mood of the country has actually flowed rather fast away from the Tories. And I think that is part of the, you know, that's a political thing. You know, we've had Brexit and now people want to talk about social issues, and Theresa May has failed at doing that. This week, for the first time, I also saw, interestingly, that some of the commentators on the right, some of the columnists, some of the most, the biggest fans of Theresa May were beginning to offer words of advice, because I think they're getting nervous. They're saying, Theresa, you know, you need to speak to the people. You need to have a nicer tone. You need to turn up to the debates when they have them. So it's interesting that there is a mood change in their coverage.
Both of you, just put this into context, because, of course, a lot of people, a lot of our listeners are not on this island. They're not following British politics that closely. But I think everyone will have heard about the fact that Theresa May did not show up for a debate at this point 3 nights ago. Andrew, just put that into context. I mean, if you're sitting, you know, in France, if you're sitting in the United States, if the fact that, you know, someone who is running for the highest office of the country doesn't show up, and well, in this case, sent the Home Secretary, rather strange.
So the background to this is that she wanted to appear better than everybody else. She was above politics. She was going to be this amazing prime minister that united the whole of the country, and she didn't want to be seen to be squabbling with people who are going to get, you know, 2 or 3 seats in the end if she was on with Caroline Lucas, for example, from the Green Party. So she said, I'm not going to go. I'm going to send one of my team, Amber Rudd, and I will sit this out because I'm going to be going around the country talking to real people face to face. Now, it didn't turn out well because of the poll shift, and also because Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, played a blinder at the last minute and said, oh, I am going to turn up, after saying he wasn't going to turn up. So everyone was there. There was a party without her, and it just looked bad. And it didn't play well with her constituency either, despite the paper saying she did the right thing, trying to shore her up. It's gone down very badly. And again, that's one of the cracks you're now seeing in the coverage by columnists on the right saying, actually, this was a mistake. She should have been there, because if you're not there, then you just get called out all the time.
And Chris, it sort of smacked of arrogance then as well, because we had by Thursday evening into Friday morning the notion of arrogance, America being the single nation out when it comes to climate change as well. And I believe a lot of people also sort of, you know, look back to, of course, you know, walking along the White House corridors, Donald Trump and Theresa May hand in hand.
Hand in hand, absolutely. I think Andrew's absolutely right as well. I mean, it's just, I think the problem is it completely backfired, that the stunt that she tried to do. And I think, in fact, it didn't make her look above things. And in fact, I think a lot of people in this country probably don't want people who think that they are above things and above politics right now. They want people with policies and ideas who are engaged with this stuff, I would say.
Another interesting thing is that, you know, which is a failure on both sides, is that whatever the result is, that neither side is very good at reflecting what the opposition thinks. So, for example, even when you go to a left-wing newspaper like The Guardian, they haven't really done very well at covering what the right is reporting and thinking. And the same when you go to The Telegraph or The Times, you know, centrist or centre-right papers. Again, there's no reflection on they can't quite explain why Corbyn is getting this cut through, because they won't listen to his side of the story. So whichever newspaper you read, you feel in the UK you're left with a rather isolated opinion, just the kind of thing that the Washington Post and the New York Times have tried to counter in recent weeks by always trying to bring in stuff you should read from the other side, even if you don't agree with it.
I think these... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I think these... I absolutely agree with Andrew. And, you know, coming back to the UK after... We mentioned I used to run the bureau in Istanbul and seeing...
You've
the way...
You've said that twice in this programme. I think all of our listeners
seeing the way... I used to live in Turkey, just in case anyone's unclear about it. But coming back to the UK and being here throughout an election season and seeing the way... You know, just 2 weeks ago, The Telegraph had on the front page a picture of Jeremy Corbyn that looked like an Arthur Scargill 1970s kind of, you know, anti sort of mining protest. And, and what I'm saying is that Andrew's right. They cannot cover the other side very well, despite all this effort that people are talking about, that we started the conversation talking about soul searching in the wake of Donald Trump. They still cannot get beyond these very simplistic tropes.
Gentlemen, just before we go, just to both of you, do you think that this is going to result in a higher turnout at this point? If I am a Tory supporter, I thought, okay, everyone's going to, it's going to be a bit of a shoe-in, no problem. You know, I was probably going to take, you know, I was thinking about taking the afternoon off, I'm going to be at work, I'm not going to go to the polls. What's it going to do at the ballot box, Andrew?
I think there's going to be a higher turnout, but specifically in the categories of young voters, 18 to 25, and in people who are traditional, should be traditionally Labour supporters, but haven't voted in recent years. So the kind of people that Trump actually got out to vote, people who feel disaffected with politics, who find in Corbyn someone they want to vote for. That's not saying I think he's going to win. I don't think he is, but I do think he is going to galvanise a voter who hasn't been to the polls for a long time.
Chris Lord, formerly of our Istanbul Bureau.
I would say, I would agree with Andrew in as much as I think the big turnout is going to have to be those young people who Corbyn spoke for at a certain point when we saw that landslide of people joining the Labour Party in his arrival to politics. Those kind of people are going to be very, very important in this vote next week.
Chris Lord, formerly of our Istanbul Bureau. Now our features editor here at Monocle, Andrew Tuck, our editor. Gentlemen, you've got pages to get out the door. You're listening to The Stack here at Monocle 24. Back after this. And that's all for this week's show. Many thanks to our producers, Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our editor has been Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. And if you fancy buying some of the titles mentioned on The Stack, do pay a visit to the Kiosk Cafe, our very own Monocle newsstand in Paddington here in London. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tyler Brulé. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.